Right. Thank you very much. So this talk is based on a paper you can find on the archive. That's this one here. And it kind of follows on from much earlier work, this work on axioms, and you can read a paper on that. That's that one here. So one of the great problems, I'm not a philosopher, so I don't need to sit down. One of the great problems that faces us is unification of quantum theory and general relativity. People have been trying to do this for quite some time. Most of the people trying to do this come from a quantum field theory background or a general relativity background. And it's only recently that people coming from a quantum information stroke quantum foundations background have been looking at this, and I certainly fit into this category. So here's the idea. Let's look at the two component theories and see what the essential features of these theories are. So we'll take general relativity first. If we look at general relativity, then consider some interval between two space-time points. In order to know whether that interval is space-like or time-like, we have to solve Einstein's field equations for the metric. And then once we know the metric, we can decide whether that interval is space-like or time-like. What this means is the causal structure is not fixed in advance, but rather you find the causal structure by solving the equations. So in a sense, a radical feature of general relativity is that the causal structure is not fixed in advance. If you look at quantum theory, on the other hand, then the causal structure is fixed in advance. So here are two ways of illustrating this. Is it too loud? Maybe. Okay. Okay, so one way of illustrating this is to see that we have a background time in quantum theory. So the state is evolved by acting on it with some unitary operator U of t. This is background time here. So we see that we have to know what constitutes some kind of space-like slicing in order to know how to evolve the state. So we have to have some causal structure fixed in advance. And then there's another way of seeing it, a more subtle way of seeing it, which is to look at the way we combine operators in quantum theory. So consider operators associated with these four regions. And this might be two qubits, for example, passing through various gates. For the AB region, we combine the operators using the tensor product. And this is a space-like separated situation. For the CB region, we combine the operators using the direct product. And this is a time-like separated thing. And it's also immediately it's an immediate separation. So C follows on immediately from B. So we use the time-like product, the time. We use the direct product. And then there's another situation, DB, where there's a gap in the middle. And in this situation, you can define what I call the question mark product. So the question mark product acts on an operator like so. It's defined like that. And that's a linear operator that's well-defined within quantum theory, should you care to search for it. And then there's another feature that we have here, which I'm going to call compression. So if we look at the first case, if we take the tensor product of two operators to get the tensor product, then it's possible to go backward. It's possible to go from the tensor product back to those two operators separately. However, that's not the case for this product. if we have the direct product of two operators, if I just give you that, it's not possible for you to go backwards and obtain the operators C and B separately. So in some sense, information is lost. There's a kind of compression happening. It turns out that the question mark product is very much like the tensor product. There's no compression. And so this compression is really a feature of when you have a kind of immediate causal adjacency. So if two regions are immediately influencing one another causally, then you get this compression. So I'm going to try and situate this idea in a more general framework and show you how it's possible to build a more general framework that might be suitable for quantum gravity. So what's the idea? Well, the idea is to combine, is to find a framework that combines the radical elements of the two component theories. If we look at general relativity is a deterministic theory, and in that sense, it's not that, in that sense, it's conservative. It's similar to the theories that preceded it. But it has non-fixed causal structure, and in that sense, it's quite radical. It's different from the theories that preceded it. Quantum theory is conservative in that it has fixed causal structure, but it's radical in the sense that it has this necessary probabilism, this necessary reference to probabilities built into it. So if we're going to try and combine, find some framework which is suitable for quantum gravity, it seems likely that it should have both the radical features. So we're looking for a framework which is probabilistic, but doesn't have to have a fixed causal structure. And I'll show you a framework like this. It's called the causaloid framework. And it's possible to put quantum theory into this framework. I hope it's also possible to put general relativity into the framework, although I haven't successfully done that yet. And then, of course, I also haven't successfully found a theory of quantum gravity, but I hope that this is the right framework for such a theory, or at least approximately the right framework. So I take very much an operational approach. This is something that general relativity and quantum theory have in common. They were both founded, at the very least, on operational insights. I take the operationalism as a kind of methodology, not as a fundamental philosophy. So operationalism is a methodology which is aimed at constructing theories. One doesn't have to believe in operationalism as a fundamental philosophy in order to use it as a methodology. So I start with an assertion. A physical theory, whatever else it does, must correlate data. It seems that's necessary for a physical theory to be empirical. If it doesn't correlate data, then it doesn't really constitute physics. So given that, let's think about what kinds of theories might correlate data. So here's an example. We've got these two probes which are floating around in space. And each probe has a clock inside it that ticks. And at each tick time, we record some data. Here I've shown the data being recorded onto a card each time. And these probes, for example, might have some knobs on them that you can vary. And they might have some detectors or something that detect ambient particles in the environment, for example. And we can think of this region of space-time like this. And this is just an example, but this is a sort of general picture. And maybe the data that's collected here is this data 1, and the data that's collected here is this data 2. And then what we're interested in doing is finding a theory that enables us to calculate probabilities like this one, probability of data 1 given data 2. So we have to be a bit careful. So let me introduce this notion of well-defined probabilities with an example. So we have here an example with a spin half particle that is subjected to three sequential spin measurements along various different directions. And we get a result for each one plus or minus a half. So the first probability I've written down here is well-defined, and we can calculate it from quantum theory. The probability that we see a particular result here, say plus a half, given that we know the result here and we know these settings, that's a well-defined probability we can calculate using the machinery of quantum theory. On the other hand, this probability is not well-defined. So this is the probability that we see a particular result here on the third apparatus, given some particular direction, and given also that we had a particular result on the first one and a particular direction, but without saying anything about what happened in the second position. So that probability cannot be calculated by quantum theory because, of course, the second measurement might disturb the quantum state. And unless we specify as part of the conditionalization what is going on there, we actually can't calculate this probability. Now, if you think about it, if you're looking at probabilities between bits, between data from arbitrary regions in general, then the situation where probabilities are not well-defined is going to be pretty generic. It will be unusual for probabilities to be well-defined. The reason we don't normally think about this is because normally we restrict our attention to probabilities that we know are well-defined by referring to some particular fixed causal structure. So for example here, there's some causal structure in that the second measurement follows the third one. Sorry, it follows the first one, whereas the third one doesn't. So we know intuitively that this probability is going to be well-defined, whereas this one isn't. However, if we don't have fixed causal structure, then we have to be a lot more careful. So the approach I want to take is to be able to write down directly an expression for this probability. Well, write down directly some expressions that tell you, first of all, whether this probability is well-defined or not, and then if the probability is well-defined, what the probability is equal to. Okay. And the reason we have to be much more careful is because we don't have this fixed causal structure to refer our calculations to. So here's a key idea that goes into this. This is the idea of compression due to a physical theory. I've started calling this physical compression. So if you look at physical theories, what generally physical theories relate different quantities. That means that if you want to know the values of all the quantities, it's not necessary to specify all the quantities separately. You can specify a subset of those quantities and then use the physical theory to calculate the remaining quantities from that subset. So you only need to work with a compressed set. So here's an example. Take a spin half particle in quantum theory. Well, there's its density matrix. We have probability of getting spin up and spin down along the z direction on the diagonal. And then we have A and A star as the off-diagonal elements. You can do a calculation and show that this off-diagonal element A is given by this expression, where px plus is the probability of getting spin up along the x direction, and py plus is the probability of getting spin up along the y direction. So we see that the information that's contained in this density matrix is also contained in this list of four probabilities. It's the same information. So if we know this, then we know the density matrix and vice versa. These two objects are, in some sense, equivalent. Also notice that since this expression is linear, these two objects are linear in each other. So now imagine that we want our state to be some object that we can use to calculate the spin along an arbitrary direction, or to calculate the probability for an arbitrary outcome of an arbitrary measurement. That means we want to be able to calculate any of these probabilities in this very, very long list. Okay, this is an arbitrary, the probability of an arbitrary outcome along an arbitrary direction. However, we know that in order to calculate that in quantum theory, it's only necessary to specify a reduced set of probabilities. Okay. So we have a kind of linear compression. If we specify just this reduced set, then we can calculate all the others. So we're compressing down to a shorter list. And in order to decompress, we need to know the appropriate linear, some appropriate set of linear matrices that enable us to go from this set to an arbitrary element in this set. So if we label the elements of this set with L and the elements of this set with alpha, then we have some rectangular matrix, some very rectangular matrix like this, which will enable us to decompress. So this is compression due to the physical theory itself. And it's a very generic feature of physical theories. So in quantum theory, we have here the usual formula, the trace, the probability of some particular outcome is given by the trace of the operator associated with that outcome times the density matrix. This density matrix is linearly related to the vector P that I showed you on the previous transparency. That's this compressed list of probabilities. And therefore, the operator A will be associated with some vector R. There's an association like this. So remember, I showed you earlier all of these different types of product that we could consider. In the causaloid framework, I'm going to unify all those products into a single type of product, which I call the causaloid product. So the causaloid product will give us a way of combining arbitrary vectors of this nature and without having to think about the particular causal structure. In this case, in order to know whether you should take the tensor product, the question mark product, or the direct product, you have to know what the causal structure is between the two regions. This slide is just to illustrate the notation I'm going to use. So we imagine we have some big space-time region, R. And then inside that space-time region, we have some general regions, R1 and R2. And then R sub X is an elementary region. So we imagine that there are some smallest regions, and R sub X is an example, is an elementary region. So a general region like R1 can be regarded as the union of a whole bunch of elementary regions where X is in some appropriate set. So I'm now going to show you how to implement compression to get a general framework. And we have three levels of compression. So there are three levels of this physical compression that I'm going to tell you about. So here's the first one. This is the first level of compression. So what we do is we take this big region, and now we regard it as being composed of two parts, so region R1 and then everything else. And then in region R1, we have F sub R1, which represents the choices of settings in that region. So this will be the choices of knob settings and so on that we make inside that region. So for example, it might be the choice of direction along which we measure spin. And then X, big X, represents the outcomes in region 1. Okay. For the moment, ignore this alpha. I'll come back to the alpha later. And then likewise, in this region R minus R1, we have some outcomes and some choices of settings. And we can just consider the probability of all this data given all these choices, given all these outcomes given all these choices. Okay. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to regard what happens outside of the region R1. In other words, this stuff, I'm going to regard this stuff as constituting a kind of generalized preparation for what happens inside. So it's a generalized preparation because it isn't really a preparation as such. It's not something that happens at an earlier time, but it's something that happens at an earlier time, a later time, and also to the sites. So we regard what happens here as a generalized preparation for what happens inside this region. And now we have various different things that could happen inside the region. So we have all the possible choices of setting and then all the possible outcomes. I'm going to label each of these by alpha 1. Okay, so alpha 1 is labeling the different choices plus outcomes in the region. So now I'm just putting in the subscripts, the superscripts everywhere, alpha 1, also down here. And then I'm going to call this probability P sub alpha 1. So this is the joint probability of getting all this stuff for a given generalized preparation outside region 1, and then for some given alpha 1. So give some given choice of settings and outcomes in region 1. So in this region, region 1, I'm going to regard the state as being something that you can use to calculate all the probabilities P sub alpha 1. These are all the these are all the joint probabilities for some given generalized preparation outside that region for all the different things you could have inside the region. So this is a very long list of probabilities. But we have a physical theory, and in general, a physical theory will cause some linear compression, some physical compression, rather. So we're going to imagine this list being actually represented by a shorter list of probabilities. Here they are. This is a much shorter list of probabilities where these labels L belong to some particular set. And then if you know this shorter list of probabilities, then you can calculate any list in this set. From this shorter list of probabilities, you can calculate any probability in this much bigger set. So it's very much the same idea that I showed you before with the example of a spin half particle. Okay. And in particular, I'm going to look at linear compression. So the functions that implement this compression or implement the decompression have to be linear. Now that's an arbitrary choice that we can make, but it makes sense in the context of a probabilistic theory where probabilities generally add in a linear fashion. Okay. So now we have this object here, which is representing the state. And this is a compressed object of probabilities where the probabilities belong to this indexed set L belonging to some set omega. Okay. The decompression is encoded in these vectors R sub alpha 1. And so I'm going to define the components of these vectors in this way. So now we have a matrix which encodes the first level decompression. So if we know this matrix and we know the state, then we can calculate an arbitrary probability P sub alpha 1. And that's the first level compression. So second level compression happens when we have two or more regions. So first level compression was for a single region. Second level compression is for two or more regions. So here's a space diagram again. And then we're just going to consider the case of two regions. So we have region R1 and region R2, and I have the settings plus data outcomes, settings plus outcomes labeled by alpha 1 here, and likewise alpha 2 in this region. And then we can write down a probability similar to before, but now we have alpha 1 and alpha 2. And we can think of this as being, we can think of this in the same way as we did before, but now we have a generalized preparation for the union of R1 and R2, where the generalized preparation is everywhere else. And in the same way, we can think about the state. So the state is something that we can use to calculate all these joint probabilities, p alpha 1, alpha 2. But we can use linear physical compression to compress down to a smaller list of joint probabilities. And the labels in this smaller list are k1, k2, and they belong to some particular set, omega 1, 2. Okay. So this is very much the same thing we did before, but now for the joint region, R1 and R2. And now there's an important theorem which says that this, we can always find a choice for omega 1, 2, which is a union of the Cartesian product of omega 1 and omega 2. So an example. It might be, for example, that omega 1 is equal to 1, 2, 3, 4. And omega 2 is also equal to 1, 2, 3, 4. The Cartesian product then, of course, is the set of all labels. It's the set of all pairs. And then an example for 1, 2 might be this. Now, in the case where omega 1, 2 is a proper subset of omega 1 cross omega 2, such as an example I gave you, then we have a kind of non-trivial second-level physical compression. This is very much like the example I showed you at the beginning. When we take the direct product of two operators, we end up losing information. We have less parameters. We're not able to recover all the parameters we initially had from the product of two operators. And so this non-physical second-level physical compression is normally associated with a kind of causal adjacency. Just like before, we can write a general probability in terms of some special set of vectors R, sub alpha 1, alpha 2, dot product with the state for the combined region. And now we can define these matrices by just taking the special set of components here, which are in the product set. And then the k's are the, these are the components of these vectors, the k1, k2 components. So this is a special set of matrices. And these matrices define the second level linear compression. So what's happening is at the first level, for each region separately, you have a certain amount of compression. But then when you take the two regions together, it's possible, in fact, if you have non-trivial compression, then it will happen, that you get some additional compression. That's a compression in addition to the first level compression that you saw already. And you can use this second-level compression, these matrices that come from second-level compression, to define what I call the causal loop product. So if you take an arbitrary vector for the two regions, then you can put together two vectors using this causal loop product. And this is the thing that unifies, in the case of quantum theory, all those different products, that, you know, A cross B, A tensor product B, A times B, or A question mark B. This is a more general thing that unifies all those and puts them under a more general setting. And this second level compression, I've just shown you how it works for two regions, but you can go through the same procedure for three regions or four regions or five regions and so on. So that's first and second level compression. Now, Now we come to third-level physical compression. So this is something a bit different. So we can write down those lambda matrices, these matrices, for all the elementary regions, and then for all pairs of elementary regions, and then for all triples of elementary regions, and so on. Okay. So these are all the lambda matrices that we get. These are from first-level compression, and all these ones are from second-level compression for two regions, for four regions, and so on. Now, it turns out that these matrices themselves are also going to be related by your physical theory. Okay. And if something is related by a physical theory, then you can use physical compression. Okay. So these things themselves are related. So we can compress using the equations that come from the physical theory that relate them down to a much smaller set of these lambda matrices, plus some set of rules that tell us how to go backwards. So we know this small set of matrices and the set of rules, then we can decompress and go back to all of this. So I haven't developed the theory of third-level compression in general. What I have done is developed an example. So here's an example is in the case of quantum theory. So I won't go through all the details of how this works, but just give you the basic idea. So an example, the example is quantum theory for a set of interacting qubits. So we have qubits. For example, here's a qubit going through this diagram. Here's another one. And every time the two qubits meet, we have an arbitrary gate applied to that pair of qubits. So we can just show this diagram slightly more schematically here in terms of links and nodes. And now it turns out that this object, I forgot to say this, I'm calling this thing the causaloid. This object, which is the compression of all these matrices, I'm calling that the causaloid. So we can show that this object, the causaloid, is actually specified by giving just this limited set of lambda matrices. So we need to specify the lambda matrix on each node, and then we need to specify the lambda matrix for each link. So if we have m nodes, then the number of lambda matrices we need to specify is of order m. On the other hand, the total number of lambda matrices that there are is exponential in m. And so it turns out that just knowing these lambda matrices, it's possible to calculate an arbitrary lambda matrix for this graph. So you might, for example, want to calculate the lambda matrix between that node and this node, and you can calculate it from this. Or you might want to calculate the lambda matrix between here and here, or the lambda matrix for these three nodes. It's possible to do that just by having this restricted set of lambda matrices. And so it turns out that from this thing, the causaloid, you can get all the predictions of quantum theory for this situation. So I'll show you how one uses this framework to make predictions. So remember, the sort of thing we want to calculate is the we want to know whether the probability of data 2, given data 1, is well-defined. And if it is well-defined, what it's equal to. Okay. So here's the probability of some data 2. The data collected in region 2 is this. Given data 1, and this is the data collected in region 1. Well, this is a conditional probability. And we can use Bayes' rule to calculate it from the joint probabilities that we know that we have already. So we calculate it like this. It's the dot product of the joint probability for this data divided by the appropriate normalization factor, where we sum over all the other possible outcomes, x, in region 2. So that's the appropriate thing. Now, if you look at this, we're conditioning here only on what happens inside region 1 and 2. We're not saying anything about what happens outside regions 1 and 2. But the state P is associated with the it's associated with the generalized preparation outside regions 1 and 2. So in order for this probability to be well-defined, it shouldn't depend on the state P. Okay, that's not something that we're conditionalizing on. So we want this thing to be independent of P. The only way that's possible is if this vector is parallel to this vector. If these two vectors are not parallel, then there'll be some dependence on P. Okay, so this is well defined if and only if this vector here is parallel to this vector. So now we know how to answer the first question, is the probability well defined? This is the answer. And then the second question, what is the probability equal to? Well, this probability P is then given just by the scale factor between these two vectors, as we can see from this equation. So we have a framework which looks like this. We need to know the causaloid, okay, and this is this highly compressed object, and the causaloid is theory dependent. And then we need to know some set of basic equations which are theory independent. Any theory expressed within the causaloid framework will have the same set of basic equations. And then if we know these two things, it's possible to calculate all these probabilities. So any probability that the theory should calculate can be calculated from these two components. It's interesting to contrast this approach with other approaches. So we can ask, how do we usually go about correlating data in physical theories? Well, there are three approaches, I think, you can find. The first approach is to use an evolving state. So imagine you want to correlate data in these two regions. What you can do is write down some state at time t1 that includes this data here, and then evolve the state until you get to time t2 that includes this data, and then you'll use the machinery of the physical theory to calculate the appropriate correlation. A second method is where you write down local laws, so for example, the Einstein field equations, and then what you do is you find a solution that's globally consistent with this data here and here in accordance with these local laws, and then again, you should be able to work out some correlation between these two data, if there is such a correlation. And then a third approach is to look at histories. So in history approaches, you consider entire histories of data that might be collected between some initial time and some final time. And then you use the machinery of the theory to look and see what histories include this data 1 and data 2. And then again, you should be able to calculate some probabilities. So you'll see all these approaches have in common that they require consideration of data besides the particular data that you're interested in correlating. Okay. So in order to do this, you need to consider data at intermediate times. In order to do this, likewise, you always have to consider additional data apart from data 1 and data 2. Whereas the approach that I've shown you directly correlates data 1 and data 2. It tells you immediately if there's a correlation between those two pieces of data and then what that correlation is equal to. So it's a different approach to these usual approaches that we have in thinking about physical theories. One thing that makes these approaches problematic is something that you might call the problem of time in quantum gravity. So actually, there are many problems associated with time in quantum gravity, and this is just one of them. And I think it's actually not even what people usually mean when they refer to the problem of time. So here's a problem of time in quantum gravity. If you consider different distributions of matter, then of course you have different causal structure, because you get different metrics associated with those different distributions. So if you end up taking something like a superposition, a quantum superposition, and of course, until we actually have a theory of quantum gravity, we don't know what it means to take a superposition. But something like that, of different matter distributions, then we're not going to have any matter of fact as to what the causal structure is, because we're superimposing over different types of causal structure. On the other hand, quantum theory has a time in it, and so it seems to need to know what the causal structure is. It needs to know what it means to have a time-like interval. And yet here it seems like we don't know what that is. And so this looks like a problem for quantum gravity, and it's kind of behind Penrose's ideas to do with collapse. So the approach that I've shown you gets around this problem because it directly correlates data without reference to some background time. So let me conclude. So in the causaloid formalism, we regard a region as being composed of lots of elementary regions, and we treat all these elementary regions on an equal footing. So in particular, we can treat the operation of putting together operators from arbitrary regions on an equal footing. We don't have to treat each type of way of doing this in a different way as we do in quantum theory. This framework is sufficient to formulate the quantum theory of interacting qubits, pairwise interacting qubits, and it so turns out that you can implement universal quantum computation with pairwise interacting qubits. So that's a very general example. I hope that it will be possible to formulate quantum gravity. First of all, I hope that it will be possible to formulate general relativity in this framework, and I have some vague ideas on how to go about that, but I think it's a big project to actually work out how to do this. It seems that the basic philosophy in this framework is quite similar to Einstein's basic philosophy in setting up general relativity in the first place, but there's still a massive technical bridge to cross before I can say that I've managed to formulate general relativity. And then, in addition, I think this framework, because it combines but allows you to combine the radical elements from the two physical theories, quantum theory and general relativity, that we're looking at, it should provide an appropriate mathematical setting for a theory of quantum gravity. Thank you. Like what, sorry? Orderloid, right. Yeah. No. So the causality shows up in, especially in this second level compression. So if you get second level compression, that's something that's generally associated with causal adjacency. So two systems are more correlated than they would be if there's some direct causal contact between them. And that ends up being translating into second-level physical compression, and so that's very much something that's built into the causaloid. In addition, this third level of compression, which I didn't discuss in any detail, also contains a lot of information about the causal structure. So in a way, it's the third level of causal, the third level of physical compression is a kind of mathematically neutral way of seeing the kind of global causal structure that you might have. Okay, so, I mean, if the point you're making is that there's a difference between correlation and causality, okay, that's a different point, and maybe one could call it something terrible like the correlatoid, but I don't like that name. I mean, clearly there's a link between correlation and causality, but I think any distinction between those two concepts is very much in the realm of philosophy rather than physics, from the point of view of a working physicist. You know, correlation and causality are really the same thing.
I was surprised when
Okay.
So I have the feeling you're coming at this from the way that I talk to David.
Okay. Let's imagine, just for the sake of argument, we have two points, one here and one here, which you know, these two points happen to have two particles crossing, and these two points happen to have another two particles crossing. So we know where they are, at least they're defined with reference to those particles crossing. But now we wonder if it would be possible, if it's possible in principle for a particle to pass between those two points. Now, of course, we haven't actually sent a particle between those two points. But we could ask, would it be possible in principle for a particle to do that? And then I think you can answer that question by looking at the metric and seeing if the metric would allow a time-like path between those two points. I think in the context of general relativity, it's not such a problem. But if you now go to quantum gravity, whether you send a particle or not, actually changes what happens. You know, so there's a beautiful experiment by Mandel. I don't know if you, I always like to. Let me draw it here. So these are two parametric down converters. Okay, and you have a pair of photons produced here, and a pair of you have either a pair of photons produced here or a pair of photons produced here, and you don't know which one. And now you combine these two at a beam splitter, okay? And this photon and this one have the same frequency. So Mandel showed in his experiment that because you don't know whether this photon came from here or here, you actually see interference between these two photons. But if you place an obstacle in here, then you lose the interference. So the physical effect you see over here is influenced by whether or not there's a particle allowed to pass along this path. And so likewise, in quantum gravity, the physics that you would get if you actually probe the causal structure with particles would be different than the physics you would get if you didn't probe the causal structure with particles. I mean, ultimately, yeah, because I'm sort of working towards a theory of quantum gravity, so. So I think these kinds of considerations. So in classical GR, you have the luxury of just imagining that there were some test particles, and it doesn't make any difference. You know, they're sufficiently small perturbation to your physics that you would get the same solution. But that's, you don't have that luxury in quantum theory. Okay, so there's a whole section of the development of this idea I had to miss out because of time, although I kind of touched on it at the beginning. So this is an operational approach, and so really everything is defined, all the concepts I use are defined in terms of data that might be collected, and that includes the concept of elementary region. So in this example, just to give you an idea, this would be an elementary region here because I can collect data here, and I can't subdivide the data I'm collecting here into a smaller piece because it ends up going on one card, whereas this would be a composite region. So it's an operational notion, ultimately, that depends on the way you collect data and the way you analyze it. Of course, this operationalism isn't something that I'm ultimately happy with in the physical theory, but it's a means to construct a physical theory. Okay. So if I said predict a probability, that was, I was misspeaking slightly. I should talk about, you know, because predict suggests a notion of time, and I'm trying to get away from that. But to calculate a probability, let's say, I mean, at least it has to be a number between 0 and 1. But I think, so another thing, of course, I didn't touch on here is what's the correct interpretation of probability to use in this setting. And the one thing, the initial approach I take is just to think of repeating the experiment many times and calculating a relative frequency. That's ultimately unsatisfactory, and so in the paper I discuss that further. But at least as an initial way of thinking about it, I think of them as relative frequencies when you repeat the experiment many times. Okay, so I think you're right that there's a connection between the first level compression and Gleason's theorem. I mean, in a sense, Gleason's theorem is kind of backwards from this point of view. Here I think about, you know, Gleason's theorem starts out with the Hilbert space as the correct state space for measurement operators, and then works towards the state. Whereas here I'm kind of working with, you know, compressing the state and thereby calculating the appropriate measurement objects. So it's kind of sort of the opposite way around. Yeah, in answer to your question about whether Gleason's theorem is relevant to the other two things, I really don't know. And I think the trouble is Gleason's theorem is very much rooted in quantum theory, whereas this is a much more general structure. And so it's not clear to me that Gleason's theorem would be relevant. You don't need to justify the assumption as such, because it could be that there's no compression, but that's also an example of that fits within the mathematical framework. So as a last resort, you can just have the case where the compressed vector is the same length as the original one. I take your point. Yes. Yeah, so in particular, you can recover the ABL rule using this method. The equation I wrote down. I mean, you have to do a bit of work, but I think you can see that there's a similarity between this equation and the ABL rule. And then I think the sort of generalizations of the Aharonov framework that are out there that you've worked on as well would also fit within this framework. So there's probably a deep connection, which I think would be interesting to explore. I mean, I came upon this method, I came upon this thinking from a different point of view, which was thinking about the necessity to remove reference to some fixed causal structure. But at least in the context of quantum theory, you end up getting a very similar sort of framework. take your time. Yeah, so say, okay, say you take a theory where you have a kind of definite causal structure. Okay, you have a fixed causal structure specified it in advance, and then you put it through this compression machinery and you end up with a causaloid. Okay, and then you want to know, looking at that theory, of course, you probably then can't really see what's going on, but if you you want to know what the causal structure is, then you can sort of you can decompress as appropriate, and then if you look at some pair of regions, if there is second level compression, then they would be time, they would be not only time-like but also immediately sequential, so causally adjacent. And if the pair of regions are if there's no second level compression, then that would mean that there's either they're time-like, that there's a gap, or that they're space-like. And you could certainly reconstruct all the causal relations between in that way. Yeah. That's a good question. I think it's time symmetric. So I think if I gave you either that if I gave you two causaloids and didn't tell you which one was, what the sine of t was. You wouldn't know which was which, but I think it's probably oriented in the case of quantum theory, just because quantum theory is oriented, the causal influence is, quantum theory is causal in that kind of sense. It does not close time-like loops and so on. So I'm not sure, but I think it would be orientated in that sense.